Hi, my name's Noreen Jamil, and this is...
Emily Kate Stevens.
Both of us have been diagnosed with long COVID.
And we've created this podcast dedicated to the condition. Welcome to the Long COVID Sessions. So, Noreen, how was your week?
My week was uneventful, actually, in terms of my health, apart from my ongoing stiff back and my insomnia.
Okay.
So I'm not sleeping at all. According to my SleepWatch app, my disruption levels are over 200% over normal.
You know what I think about relying too heavily on those outside apps to tell you? If you don't look at your watch, how do you feel about your sleep?
No, I'm definitely not getting enough sleep or enough restful sleep.
Yeah.
But it's not impacting me in my day-to-day.
So you feel okay?
I feel okay. I mean, I don't feel full of energy.
Yeah.
But I feel I can get on with my stuff.
Okay.
But I am in bed by 8:30, 9 o'clock. Sometimes asleep by 9 o'clock.
Well, that's probably considered to be quite good from a sleep hygiene point of view.
Yes, but I'm up an hour later, so...
Oh, not so good.
But apart from that, I think I'm relatively okay. I just looked at my app. I walked 20,000 steps yesterday without even knowing.
Oh, that's great.
Walked my son to school and then had a busy day.
And you feel good today?
I'm fine.
So you're not suffering PEM from your walking?
No, but we again don't know if the PEM comes immediately after or a few days later. So I will let you know next week.
Okay.
And how are you, my love?
So I had a pretty crappy week. Very up and down. I had nearly 8 days that I didn't really go to the gym or do my yoga properly. And I was still feeling crap. So I decided I would go to the gym. And I went to the gym twice. 2 days ago, I went two consecutive days. 48 hours after the second very big session, and I feel completely fine. So now I'm really, really confused about the PEM. Had you asked me about post-exertional malaise, the reason we're focusing on that is because that is the subject of this week's guest. But if you'd asked me about it a week ago, I would have said, I think I might be suffering from post-exertional malaise at points. Historically, and we've talked about this before, I didn't think that I did, but I did when I had a cognitively heavy load or emotionally. I didn't think that I used to suffer from the physical. And now I'm confused again because I feel fine. I feel fine after lifting weights and really, really going hard in the gym.
My question is that did you feel well enough to go to the gym or were you still feeling extraordinarily bad?
Well, I was well enough to get out of bed, which I wasn't 3 days before. I had a headache and I was dizzy and I felt that kind of weird constricting poison slightly, but I took painkillers and I felt fine. I'm not recommending it, by the way. I'm just saying I was testing it because I wasn't being super active because I was feeling shit and I was still not feeling better. So you know me, I exercise for my head. So I was testing it this week to see what happened. Who knows what happens? Maybe 48 hours is not my marker. Maybe it's 72 hours. I just thought it was worth trying it to monitor it because I think otherwise there is a tendency with this kind of chronic illness that you get scared to do things. So then you stop even trying to push certain things because you're nervous that it will push you back. And I absolutely understand that because you don't want to be pushed back into a crash. But at the same time, I've got to push my limits a bit. Otherwise, I'm going to be stuck in this hole.
Yes. Apart from the fact that we're not sure that we do suffer with PEM. And so the people that do, it's not a good idea to push.
No. It's not a good idea to push over your threshold, is it? But there is some talk that it's good to try and build that threshold.
Yes. Again, there's different theories about that, isn't there?
So, absolutely. And everyone's completely on the fence as to what you use as your marker.
Yeah.
Or how you know what your threshold is.
And also, people still don't even know what causes PEM. So it's a very individual road that we're walking on.
Yeah.
I always err on the side of caution, but I don't need the gym for my mental health as much as you do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there are benefits to doing things either way, I guess.
And it's very much listening to your own body and mind. The frustration that I get from not moving, I find sometimes more detrimental.
I mean, if I'm devil's advocate here, I would say after 8 days, you're probably on the mend anyway, because your crashes seem to last about 10 days, usually, where you feel really shit for 10 days.
Yeah.
And so you were probably coming out the other end, and it was good to get back into the gym.
Yeah. I don't think that's necessarily a devil's advocate. I think that's logical. But if I did just suffer from the traditional post-exertional malaise, it should push me straight back into a crash. And I am here, surviving.
Not shaking.
I mean, the difference between the last time we recorded and this,
yeah,
is quite marked. And even 5 days ago, my parents had to come and get the kids because I was a mess. Couldn't get out of bed.
Such a weird illness, honestly.
It's such a weird illness. The reason that we're talking so much about post-exertional malaise is because this week's guest is Assistant Professor Rob Wurst, who led the study that the long COVID community refers to as the PEM study.
Yeah, which had so much buzz.
He's Assistant Professor at the Vrije University in Amsterdam, where he's part of the Department of Human Movement Sciences.
The long COVID community was very excited by it. The study came out because it's one of the first ones that really focused on PEM and found some answers.
Yeah, and looked at what actually happens in our muscles when we get pushed to VO2 max.
Your paper with regard to long COVID and the muscle abnormalities that you found in your research as related to PEM or post-exertional malaise. It's been widely cited. People are very excited by this because so many people have PEM. Maybe you could explain to us what led you to start looking at this area.
So about 3 years ago, I got a phone call right before our lecture started. And it was a clinician from the local hospital, and she was super interested in working together. She sees patients with long COVID on a daily basis, and she noticed that the people were very fatigued and exercise made their symptoms worse. So she reached out to me as an exercise and muscle physiologist, try to understand better what goes on inside the body, inside the skeletal muscles, with the disease. So we started this project as a super simple project, thinking, let's try out a few participants, see what the muscle abnormalities are in these patients. And can we find a biological evidence of their increased fatigue? Now, this suddenly or very quickly got out of hand because we got so many interested participants that we, within 2 weeks after the ethics application was approved, we got 25 participants, the maximum amount of patients that could include in our study.
Initially, was the study set up to look at musculoskeletal abnormalities in long COVID patients, or was it specifically looking at the post-exertional malaise? Did you see a difference before you added the exercise in?
Yeah, so the idea was to do a combination of a longitudinal study as well as a cross-sectional comparison between patients and controls. We quickly understood in the preparation of the project that when exercise worsened it, you want to do a biopsy before and after an exercise bout so that you can better understand the differences that are occurring, so that you don't do a simple cross-sectional comparison. And then everyone would then say, well, also the patients are less active or they do this, do that. That's something that a lot of people have done in the past, still are doing. But we opted for a cross-section as well as a longitudinal comparison. And this allowed us to better understand the changes that occur with exercise. The idea was specifically focusing on the skeletal muscle because, I mean, I'm a skeletal muscle physiologist. We can take skeletal muscle biopsies. So super small pieces of muscle we can take out of the upper leg and study these in detail. That's our specialty, and that's what we also focus on in this project.
There are a lot of things that have come out of this study that you have found, and there are also some things that you've managed to almost disprove or remove from your hypothesis. Would you be able to talk us through, in relatively lay terms, what you found the differences to be?
So the first thing that we looked for were specific things that could explain their general feeling of fatigue. And we know there are structural changes in the skeletal muscle that can explain general feelings of fatigue. So for instance, the color of your muscle, if red, you're better able to withstand endurance exercise, for instance. If you have whiter muscles that are not so dense with vessels as well as energy production organelles, mitochondria, then we know from a lot of our previous work that makes people more fatigued in a general sense.
And is that something to do with your muscle composition in general, or is it to do with your fitness level and the way in which those muscles have been conditioned?
Both. So there is a large genetic component to this. So the fiber type composition of your muscles is determined partly by genetics, but also partly by endurance or training status. Now, we know that these patients are a little bit less active, but we also know from other types of work where we study the effects of bed rest, really strict bed rest on the skeletal muscle abnormalities, that we don't see these fiber type shifts, that difference that we saw in our study, suggesting that other factors and maybe linking to inflammation can change the fiber type composition in the muscle.
And just to clarify, these people were actually active. They were doing at least 4,000 steps a day. And so
exactly.
They weren't of a exactly. cohort that had been hospitalized or on complete bed rest.
Yes, exactly. So indeed, all the participants that we included in our study were mildly infected in the acute phase, didn't require hospitalization, and they were relatively still active. The reason for that is that we had to get them to our hospital to do a bike test, and they had to come back into the hospital afterwards. So the bedridden patients that we also hear about were not fit enough, essentially, to even go to the hospital to undergo the tests that were required. We do think that the results are also applicable for the very severely ill patients, but for our study, we could not include those.
So there is almost a genetic component to how your muscles...
Well, that's a very good question. The problem is a little bit that we don't know who is vulnerable to get long COVID and who does not. So we cannot see before their infection how their muscles look like. That makes it, of course, difficult. But we assume that the fiber type composition and the way the muscle looks was the same as our healthy cohort beforehand.
Could you not test a member of the family for comparison?
Yeah, so some of the control participants, the healthy control participants, were actually family members of the patients, and that allowed us indeed to reduce a little bit of that variability. But we also made sure that the healthy controls had the same BMI, body mass index, same age, and also the gender composition of the cohort was similar.
And did you consider any comorbidities and prior conditions when you were actually recruiting the 25 people?
Yes, we did. And we made sure that there were as little as possible comorbidities. So all the participants that were part of our study were between the age of about 20 and 55 years old. They were all healthy before the onset of the disease and didn't have any other comorbidities, other than the primary disease long COVID.
So what were the differences that you were seeing?
Oh, yes. So we did see the fiber type shifts in our cohort, but those are structural changes that cannot explain the onset of post-exertion malaise. So post-exertion malaise, or PEM, is the worsening of symptoms such as fatigue and muscle pain upon an acute bout of exercise. You also get more brain problems or neurological problems, but we didn't look into that. We specifically focused on skeletal muscle, but we know there are some structural changes that cannot explain sudden changes in their feelings of fatigue. So we focused on factors that are able to change within a two-day period. And we focus on their metabolism. So their metabolism to produce is mainly aimed to make ATP, the energy that is required for us to move around. And there we saw really big differences between the patients and our controls. The way that the muscle is able to generate energy by using these organelles called mitochondria was different between the patient and the controls, but also worsened in the patients one day after a Maxwell exercise test. So we know that normally exercise is good for you, and exercise improves these organelle functions, the mitochondrial function and energy producing functions of the muscle. But in our patients, we saw the opposite happening, that it worsened. And that makes us think that maybe there's a vicious circle occurring, that when you are constantly going over the threshold to induce the post-exertional malaise, that you constantly get a reduction in the mitochondrial function. Another thing that we spotted was that there was more muscle damage in these biopsies from the patients. So we looked for infiltration of immune cells, so immune cells in the muscle, and they were different. Different types of immune cells were different in the patients as well as compared to the controls. Also, after exercise, we saw significant muscle damage in the patients that we didn't see so much in the control group. So we think that extensive muscle damage and related to breakdown of proteins and breakdown of muscle fibers can be a sign for, well, it can be the underlying reason for muscle pain, for instance, that you also would see when you would, for instance, go downhill running or exercise that is known to damage your cells a little bit. But we saw way more of that in our patient cohort. So that makes us think that exercise in patients has the option to increase feelings of fatigue because the muscle cannot produce as much energy anymore, as well as muscle pain, where the muscle becomes more damaged.
Now, your study was done using a static bike. So you were pushing people to their VO2 max, to their sort of cardio max. You did not see changes in their cardiac response. Is that correct?
Yes.
What really interests me about this is that you were essentially stressing their cardio system rather than necessarily their muscular system. From my experience, I can't do cardio work in the way that I used to, but I am fine to do yoga, muscle strengthening, and I'm on the fence as to whether I can do weights. I try and reintroduce weights, and I don't know if that induces PEM. I'm interested in the way that cardio stress creates muscle stress and that process. Is there a way that you can explain what happens there?
Yes, I hope so. We know from the patients that we see and also other patients that contact us as part of this project that likely there is different subgroups of patients with long COVID. And some of them suffer from brain fog type of symptoms, others more from autonomic dysfunction, POTS or orthostatic intolerance, and others suffer more from skeletal muscle abnormalities. So we think that there are different subgroups that have different possibly underlying mechanisms. In our study, we focus particularly on the skeletal muscle. We know that also after the exercise, patients had worsened brain problems or memory problems. Some people fainted more easily after our exercise. So we do think that there are different parts of the body reacting to the exercise. And in our study, we really focus particularly on the skeletal muscle, partly because that's my expertise, and also partly because that was for us the low-hanging fruit, because that's where we are good at, and that's how we started this project. Of course, now we want to open up to look at other symptoms as well, and maybe focus also on the blood pressure regulation at the cardiovascular system. But that's something that, of course, we would do in collaboration with teams that have that specific expertise.
And is it that when you do that cardio work that your muscles are requiring that energy draw?
Yes, of course. Yeah, yes.
So that is why pushing people on a static bike is a really good test for your whole body or muscles throughout your whole body.
Exactly. The reason why we used this exercise test was twofold. So we first wanted to know, what is their exercise capacity? How much exercise they can perform on the bike? And from that, we know what their maximum oxygen uptake consumption is. That's a typical test to see how fit you are. So therefore, we stress all the systems, the pulmonary system, the cardiovascular system, as well as the skeletal muscle system, because you have to pedal the bikes. And that becomes harder and harder and harder when the test goes on. At some point, your muscles cannot generate enough energy and enough force to to keep the pedals going. And of course, that generally coincides with the maximal function of your lungs and your heart. In that maximal exercise, at the point where they could not cycle any further, we did not see differences in their cardiac function, as general cardiac function, the heart rate, as well as their ventilation, their lung function. Of course, we did not look into a lot of details in these two different systems, and we think that maybe also in the pulmonary system, there may be some abnormalities, and there may be some abnormalities in the cardiovascular system. But grosso modo, so in general, there were no difference in the function at maximal exercise. But there were differences in the skeletal muscle system, and that's what we then focused on.
So what essentially is causing damage to the muscle?
Yeah, that's a super good question, and we simply don't know. We know that there is damage, that the mitochondria do not function properly. They may be there, but they don't work as well as we want to. But the X factor that causes these things, we are less aware of. So one of the ideas was that, for instance, the microclots could be a factor that causes these changes. Theory goes as follows, is that the microclots that are super small clots in your blood are able to block the capillaries inside your skeletal muscle. And that makes the skeletal muscle, the blood flow less easily through the skeletal muscle. And because of that, your certain areas in your skeletal muscle do not get enough oxygen and enough nutrients to generate energy. So that was a super simple explanation of the difference. So then we looked into this, and we actually did find these microclots inside the skeletal muscle. But against all the general hypothesis, they did not block the capillaries. They were outside the capillaries in between the muscle fibers. So that's made us think a little bit, what is going on here? We do know that there were more microclots in the tissue in the patients compared to healthy controls. And also they went up after exercise in some patients to very high levels.
So there's a suggestion that the exercise actually is generating these microclots.
Exactly. But we simply don't know why and how they are caused. It could be that they're caused in circulation and somehow end up in the tissue, or that they are produced inside a tissue and somehow are going into the general circulation. We don't know. So that's something that we're currently looking into about the nature and the origin of these clots. We also really don't know if you can feel them, for instance, if they cause pain, if they cause other types of symptoms. So that makes it also difficult for us to really make additional studies to figure out what is actually happening with these clots. The idea, for instance, is that these clots are not the typical clots that are linked to thrombosis clots, blood clotting. But a group in South Africa and also now other people around the world have identified that in these clots, we see autoantibodies. And autoantibodies suggested that this long COVID disease is an autoimmune disease. And that helps us a lot to understand the disease severity and the disease progression.
Seems to be going full circle, don't we?
Yeah, all of these theories we keep coming back around to. And the autoimmunity is one that has actually always been prevalent in Noreen and my minds, but it seems to at the moment being slightly pushed to one side. So that is particularly interesting, is that if there is the suggestion of the autoimmunity. Is that indicated by, you saw T-cell changes in the muscle fiber?
Yeah, so we indeed studied whether T-cells and B-cells would be more prevalent in skeletal muscle and whether there was a link with the disease. We did see more T-cells at rest, the resting biopsies in patients compared to the controls, where it was virtually absent. But it wasn't overly present in all participants, in all patients. So we simply don't know what these T cells are doing there. B cells, they're the ones that produce antibodies. Oh, so there we didn't see anything. There was no clear distinction between the patients and the controls. So yes, we do think maybe there is an autoimmune component, but we haven't looked deeply enough into the tissue and into these analyses to figure out exactly what's going on. And that partly is because we want to publish the study as it is right now and really make sure that the field knows what we have found. And of course, its research continues and we are still performing more analyses in the lab to better understand these different components, these different theories. But you can understand there are from various aspects, there are lots of follow-up questions that we get from fellow colleagues, from patients, and we also can come up with our own hypothesis why and how things are happening.
So a big theory at the moment that seems to be the favorite theory is viral persistence.
Yeah.
People are using biopsies, obviously, to find remnants of single or double-strand RNA of SARS-CoV in the tissue. Did you look or did you find any SARS-CoV-2 in the muscle?
Yes, of course. We also know about this theory, that, and we actually tested that theory too in our study. It's a favorite theory from people around the world that maybe indeed the viral persistence causes trouble. So what we did is to see whether we can find any evidence of that this theory also contributes to post-exertion malaise. And to do that, it's a bit difficult because the SARS-CoV-2 virus has different proteins. You can go for a spike protein that's on the outside of the virus, but it's also linked to vaccination. So that was one of the proteins that was the least favored of us. So we went for the end protein, which is inside the virus. So if the end protein is there, that could be that it's still able to replicate. Because the nucleocapsid proteins. So the idea was that we tested for the serum to see whether there's an increase or higher levels in patients versus the healthy controls. That was the first theory. And the second theory, does it change with the exercise? Does it rapidly change upon exercise? Answers in both cases was there was no difference. We didn't see a difference between patients and controls in the amount of end protein inside the skeletal muscle tissue. All the patients and all the controls had some sort of end protein still present. We tested, we compared it with pre-pandemic biopsies, and there the signal was completely black. So there was no background.
Wow.
So there is the suggestion that there's viral residue in everyone, regardless of...
Indeed, there is some proteins, but we don't know whether it's the full virus or whether it's just a remnant of that individual protein that is inside the virus. What we did notice, however, is that the spots were not inside cells. We saw the majority of the spots outside cells. So we know from how viruses work that they need a cell to be able to replicate. And that's what we didn't see. So we think that there's not an active viral infection that is still lingering on, but it could well be that the immune system reacts differently to the end protein that is still there in both patients and controls. So it could well be that while the end protein was equally present in both groups and did not change with exercise, there is still different activation of the immune system based on this. But we simply don't know. The fact that we didn't see active virus inside tissue suggested to us that there are remnants.
Right, but that could be a reason why in some people, maybe they've triggered some kind of autoimmune response, and that's why you see T and B cells hanging around the muscles.
True, but autoimmunity is actually a little bit different because autoimmunity works in a way that this immune system starts to attack proteins from their own body and not so much against the virus. Autoimmunity is a theory. We don't know what the contribution is to the post-exertion malaise, but where we're moving in a direction at least. But then it needs to be something that of the, that the body is producing itself, where the immune system is attacking on, essentially. Autoimmunity happens a lot with viral infections, because with viral infections, what happens is that the virus needs to enter the cell to be able to replicate. So what then occurs is that the immune cells who are surveying the body are seeing that the cell is expressing different things because there's a virus inside, but it can essentially mislabel a protein that is from itself, from the body, and label that as being a target to be destroyed. And that's how, roughly in super easy terms, how autoimmunity occurs. Essentially, a little problem, a little mistake of the immune system.
I like it, a little mistake of the immune system.
Yeah.
Feels like quite a big mistake.
It, of course, causes lots of troubles, but it starts with a small mistake.
You published an article about your study into the impact of bed rest on the human skeletal muscle. which you did allude to before, and you suggested that you're not seeing these changes due to people being inactive necessarily. But just one thing I wanted to ask from that study relating to long COVID is that you are seeing a reduction in insulin sensitivity. Is that pre-diabetes? And I just wondered if that then relates to the uptick in pre-diabetes that we are seeing in long COVID patients. Could the lack of activity lead to pre-diabetes in long COVID patients?
Those are super good questions. Indeed, we published a study last week about the effects of bed rest, strict bed rest, on skeletal muscle function. And there we see indeed rapid reduction in fiber size upon bed rest, but also changes in the metabolism that we think are leading towards a state of pre-diabetes.
And just to clarify, these patients were not long COVID patients.
No, exactly. They were healthy people. They got paid by the European Space Agency to undergo a 60-day of bed rest.
Oh my goodness. I don't want to do that.
No, don't do this. Don't do this.
Because it's bad for you.
Yeah, of course it's bad. Yeah, there are years you see negative effects on bone function, skeletal muscle health, metabolic health, brain function, etc., etc. So yes, there it's not so good, but they get paid for it. And also, that's super important. If they start exercising again, all these problems are gone away. So it means that patients or people that are just being inactive do not develop symptoms of post-exertion malaise. And they don't have any symptoms that can worsen with exercise. They actually get better with exercise. So we know that the excess in endurance or so, or the maximum optimal consumption, is similarly reduced in patients that are bedridden as well as long COVID patients. But the underlying physiology is completely different. We know from the bed rest studies that we see changes in the capillary density, in the fiber size, and the mitochondrial density, and no fiber type shift, for instance. But we see completely different things occurring in our long COVID patients. And now we try to disentangle these different factors in our future work to better understand the contribution of inactivity in the long COVID patients. However, I do agree that if you are less active and you do keep eating the same way as you did before, then of course what happens is that the body is becoming, there's an oversupply of energy inside the body, and that makes the body also less sensitive to insulin. And that can indeed explain the difference that you mentioned with the patients suffering from more pre-diabetes.
It's an interesting balance though, isn't it? Because your study is very clearly saying that graded exercise therapy, or that kind of really pushing your body when you have long COVID, is not going to be a positive thing for your body. But on the flip side of that, people need to retain a certain amount of activity to avoid other issues.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, we see from the Petra study that if you are able to, you know, to walk again and after bed, you know, after this bed rest stopped, if you start doing physiotherapy again, if you're going to the gym again, then yes, your symptoms improve. The change that we see in the skeletal muscle and the bone, they are going away again. We see something completely opposite occurring with the long COVID cohort. Exercise actually makes them worse. So physical inactivity and long COVID is not a good combination, particularly if you are going above the threshold where post-exertion malaise is being induced.
What is that threshold?
We don't know. That's something that is completely dependent on the person. So one person can have a relatively high threshold and therefore few symptoms and requires a lot of intense exercise to go over that threshold. Whereas others have a very low threshold and are going into PEM very easily. And that's exactly what we are focusing on in one of the follow-up studies, is to figure out where is this threshold and how can we increase that threshold with certain interventions.
But if the exercise is actually causing damage to the muscles, are you not just perpetually getting worse?
No, what we did in our studies, we went over the threshold of PEM. So we went to maximal exercise. So we knew also that all the patients were going over the threshold. But of course, the threshold can be different from one patient to the next. So we do think that patients should exercise within the borders or the boundaries of where damage can occur and where PEM is being induced.
Are there people other than you in the medical systems that we have that are able to assess this in people? Because I got sent by my post-COVID clinic to a sort of, it wasn't a physio, it was someone who knew about exercise. But in fact, he knew nothing about long COVID and just said that I should probably start reintroducing weights into my exercise program. Do we have that facility, or do we have people with knowledge of how to handle this?
Yeah, that's, I think, super important question for patients particularly. So the issue is a little bit that this long COVID disease, as well as chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME, has the specific symptom of post-exertional malaise where symptoms worsen with exercise. So whereas for all the other diseases, all the other conditions that we know, exercise is good for you, exercise is medicine. So diabetes, heart failure, depression, burnout, et cetera, et cetera, exercise is good for you. The weights, some case more beneficial, other cases endurance exercise is more beneficial, but we know exercise is good for you. But in these particular patients, we see the opposite. And that's something that only siphons through the physiotherapists and exercise rehabilitation scientists very slowly. And I think our work has caused some stir, particularly in that field where people still believe exercise is good for you. And we think that maybe actually there's a certain level of exercise that is good, but if you go above a certain threshold, it's really bad. And that's, I think, why there is such a lot of discussions about our paper, particularly those fields, but we know also patients that are going to the physiotherapist do not get better. They actually go worse and worse. So physiotherapists in the practice, they already know that certain types of exercise do not work with patients, that we should maybe use some sort of pacing strategies to get them better and to avoid them going over the edge.
What you've done is, because we've been talking about pacing for a few years now for the long COVID cohort, you've actually proven with your research that pacing can help, that you shouldn't do too much exercise, basically.
Exactly. I think the opposite.
You should do it within your levels, yeah.
Exactly. So if you go above the threshold where post-exertional malaise is being induced, you see that the patients that are really sick the day after, that if you go above the threshold, there are things changing in your body. We, of course, don't know whether that also happens below the certain threshold, but we know that patients can work or can function well below the threshold of this PEM. And some patients that it's super low, other patients it's a bit higher. And that's, I think, this where we are going towards in terms of medication and terms of therapies. Exercise is not that way to increase that threshold with PEM. I think it actually lowers it because it makes people go into the vicious circle where the PEM threshold is being lowered eventually. And that's how people worsen when they keep going into the physiotherapies and overexerting themselves. But if you're able to increase the threshold of PEM induction with medication and you can shorten the duration of the PEM, that of course can help a lot with daily life activities and giving life back to patients.
So what sort of medication can we use for that? Or would you recommend monitoring with heart rate variability or other things like that that we can try?
So yes, indeed, we are looking for ways where medication can increase those, the PEM threshold, shorten duration of PEM. We haven't found them yet. We have some ideas, but our work is essentially the starting point to find out where we can interfere with this system. Heart rate variability is one way that physiotherapists or sports physicians are now using to monitor the PEM essentially and to avoid going into PEM. But I have not seen a lot of super strong scientific evidence that this heart rate variability is the marker that we can use for PEM in threshold assessments.
In the opening of your study, you say that you're looking at the worsening of fatigue and pain-related symptoms after acute mental or physical exercise. I think you suggested earlier that you have not yet necessarily done a lot of work into the neurological impact of it. But are you able to in any way monitor how mental impact? Can you see in the tissues the acute mental exercise, how it affects the musculoskeletal system?
What I think is happening is that physical activity causes physical skeletal muscle changes. We also see, of course, neurological changes in the patients with symptoms related to brain fog, concentration problems, etc. So we think that the physical exercise is also able to change neurological factors. And it probably is something to do in the blood. There's a blood factor. The other way, it may work as well. There have been a lot of reports suggesting that also mental and cognitive exercise in patients can worsen symptoms. Whether cognitive function also causes change in the skeletal muscle, I don't know. And actually, I have a hard time to think how that would work because there's no physical change for it. I mean, the damage that we see is likely due to the structural physical damage and physical use of the muscle. Whether mental and cognitive exertion causes an increase in muscle pain is something that I don't know yet, whether that link exists.
That's maybe then something for your next talk.
Yeah, we have colleagues that who look into mental problems, mental exertion and mental changes. So they look at brain scans, for instance. But you cannot take a brain biopsy from a person.
But perhaps it is just that the brain is a muscle. So the same thing happens.
Yeah, yeah.
When you do find that medication, we'll love to have you back on.
Yes, I will be back. We've talked with colleagues about tests we can try to do to improve symptoms, but you know, those studies are starting hopefully this year.
The idea that your muscles are physically changed was quite frightening. So this idea all kind of lead me to the belief that our body is aging exponentially compared to other people that don't have long COVID.
Yeah.
Biologically aging quicker, don't you think?
Well, certainly, that's what it feels like, and that's what I think I look like.
You don't look like that.
Once again, it comes back to the mitochondrial function and the energy uptake and the energy that we can produce. Interesting that he did mention that the microclots that they found, but that they don't actually block the muscles.
Yeah.
So it's almost like the more systems or more parts of the body we go into, the way that we're collating all of this information about what does impact, it's just all forming a bigger map, isn't it? So that we can see what the path is of this.
Right from the beginning of our journey on this podcast, we talked about microclots because that was the key bit of information that came out right at the beginning back in 2021. But how they impact the body is still up for debate.
Yeah. And I still feel sometimes, you know, when I say that my toes have completely gone white, maybe some of this is some kind of clotting issue. You're not getting the blood flow to your extremities. We just don't have that information. But this kind of study has made real roads into the fact that they're taking biopsies of muscle and then they can see that breakdown of the tissue is really interesting. I am still really wanting to know what happens, how the cognitive impact, because it's not just me that has crashes from cognitive and emotional load. I really, really would love to understand how that translates into a physical manifestation.
Well, that harks back to last week's guest, right? Where we talk about the brain.
The brain and the body all being one.
Yeah.
Which I don't think that we can underestimate. And hopefully, all of this research, you know that so many of the people we've spoken to have said this research is really quite remarkable in the way that people are working together. Perhaps we can make some roads into treating the mind and body as one unit.
Well, just treat the body as the body with all its complicated interactive.
And the brain as being part of it.
Yeah.
As we do with everything else.
Join us next week as we hear others' experiences of long COVID. Share your stories and questions at tlcsessions.net. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram for the latest updates. And if you found this interesting, please do subscribe.